AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 140 for Friday, March 9th, 2012, In Search of Josef Ganz. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter, here we are, man.
John.
It's good to be here.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
So we got to get right to that Ford ad. Or no, cars.com ad. Hey, baby, I like that car.
The most annoying ad on the Super Bowl, but oddly memorable.
So we got to tell people, if you didn't see the Super Bowl ad, it's the stupidest ad. It's some guy goes into a dealership, and like a little version of him pops up on his shoulder. He's trying to figure out what car to buy. This guy starts singing, hey, baby, I want that car. So Peter and I have been laughing our asses off over this.
It's oddly annoying.
It's pretty good.
It sticks with you, though.
Hey, we got some good stuff in today's show. We've got the author of a new book, a guy named Paul Schilperrud, and I got to make sure if I'm saying that right or not, but he's written this interesting book about a Jewish engineer who may have really been behind the design of the original Volkswagen Beetle, and we'll be talking to Paul later in the show. And we've also got David Kiley from AOL's Auto joining us, also a guy who rode on the Volkswagen Beetle. In fact, we got a Volkswagen Beetle in the studio with us here. So some good stuff. But anyway, David, come on in. Join us.
Hey,
good having you here.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's second week in a row you've graced AOL Autos. We appreciate that.
Yeah, that's good.
That's right.
We had Scott Burgess last week, who's our new senior editor, and me this week.
So, hey, before we get into starting all that, though, I got a sad moment here. Ike the dog, our good friend here at After Hours, is no longer with us. Unfortunately, he died, and... I'm really sad about it. He was a really cool dog. And the only reason I even mention this is because since we started the show, Ike was always coming with me to the studio almost religiously. I mean, he was there for not every single show, but almost every single show.
Yeah.
And he loved coming here. And I've been amazed at traveling around and going to different industry events or media launches or whatever. People come up and say, oh, love After Hours, you know. And then almost invariably they say, how's the dog? How's Ike? And so I mention it because Ike was a favorite of people
here.
He's
part of the show. We'll miss him.
And what always cracked me up is once the show had started, he'd always come and nudge everyone's elbow, go around until they petted him. Then he'd go lie on the floor and go to sleep until the show ended. But anyway, I mentioned that because a lot of people have asked me about Ike over the last few years here. But a lot of interesting stuff going on in this business, Peter. It gets crazy. David, too. I mean, it's nuts here, man. I know you're a big EV fanatic, but Peter and I are total skeptics, and I bring it up because...
How about that, Fisker?
We'll get to that in a minute. But I mean, the real reason we launched into this is, of course, President Obama is proposing almost another $5 billion in incentives and infrastructure and all kinds of stuff for alternative fueled vehicles. So, but you like this, David?
It's more than vehicles, though. That money that Obama talked about this week is for more than vehicles.
Right, infrastructure too.
Yeah, and also just for communities and all kinds of energy saving, you know, that adopt, you know, energy saving tech and all that kind of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, I know, John, you and I have talked about this many times. I'm all in on EVs and plug-in EVs because I just think that it's It's logical. It's terribly logical. And I know that we're marketing these things into a very illogical American culture that is often hostile to things that are, I got to say, you guys are going to call me European, but often hostile to things that are plainly good for us.
Well, hold on, David. Hold on. Whoa, 1 second, because last time I looked, electric cars don't sell in Europe, and they don't sell in Japan, and they don't sell in China. In fact, they're not selling anywhere. Well, so when you say American culture and Americans don't react to the logic of it, it looks to me like not the rest of the world does either.
Well, but hang on. Europe did something different that we refuse to do in this country, which is they have created a tax structure around petrol and diesel that favors smaller, more fuel-efficient cars across the board. So we can't digest that in the American culture, and politicians won't sign up for it because everybody says it's a surefire way to get unelected. So we are pursuing this other avenue of alternative fuels. And, you know,
why don't we pursue diesels?
Well, John, I own a diesel. I'm all in, I'm all in on diesel too. But the problem is we won't create the sort of structure, pricing structure on petrol and diesel in this country to actually help drive that market. I mean, what we don't do that would benefit us as a country long term, it's shattering sometimes. I mean, we don't want to do anything. Like a parallel example to what we don't do on the car front is, I think, and the same people who argue against electric vehicles and too much government, you know, and this, that, and the other thing, are the same people that argued against putting calorie counts on menu boards. And you know what? I got to tell you, I make decisions. Every time I go up to one of those boards, I make a better informed decision about what I'm going to eat based on that information staring me in the face.
David,
but, you know,
David, I just got to ask you, are you in an undisclosed location? Because it looks like you're in a clean room. So. What is going on there, man?
I am, actually. You can't see it. There's I actually am wearing a clean suit.
And, okay.
You know, I work for AOL. I'm actually talking to you from an AOL bunker in New York. And
oh, that's
because
cool.
We're a high-tech company and you got all these mainframes here, yeah, it's
cool.
It looks very
anyway,
scientific.
I can easily, you guys have to reel me back in because I can easily get on a rant on the subject.
No, this is good. This is a good discussion because, I mean, like I said, the president just came out with a whole bunch more money. GM just announced in the last week it stopped making the Volt for 5 weeks because they're not selling. So I looked up the sales and I saw that it's outselling the Leaf 2-1 last month and outselling the Mitsubishi I by more than 40-1. It's like 44-1 or something like that.
I like the Volt.
So I'm just saying, if GM's got problems with the Volt because it's not selling and it's outselling the other two, watch out, man. I mean, Nissan and Mitsubishi, you got to be worried,
well,
too.
Well, Carlos Ghosn is...
he's all in. He's more in than you are, David.
Well, no, I know, but, you know, just a couple of things. The distribution of the vehicles has been limited, and
right.
And that's something that gets
no, that's
lost.
No, that's an important point. It's been, what, in 7 or 9 states in the United States?
You know, and it's only been very, very recently that the Volt got, I believe it just got its certification for the HOV lanes in California, which in California is huge.
That's a big thing.
Yeah, that was just a month ago.
Yeah, and honestly, here's the other thing, and I know I'm not going to change this, but... The Volt has become a political football. So
unfortunately, right.
Unfortunately. So you have roughly half the country who pays attention to those that denigrate and ridicule and want the Volt to go away for political reasons because they want to be able to put a victory against the president and the Democrats who have supported it. You get half the country basically being talked out of it from
– right. But like I said, it outsold the Leaf 2-1. So, Now, don't take too much into what I'm saying there. I'm just citing 1 month there to make a point. Yeah. But, you know, there's been months where the Leaf has been ahead, and it's got very low days inventory. They're down to 25 days. The Volt's at, like, what, 140 or something that. But nonetheless, my whole point is that EVs are not catching on like fire. We're throwing more and more money at it, thinking that's going to work. And, you know, I think the dealers know more about what's really going to happen at a retail level than the regulators do or the politicians do or even the media does. I mean, everybody makes fun of the dealers a lot in this country, but them guys is in the trenches. They know happening, and they'll tell you they can't sell these things.
I want to pass along an anecdote. It happened to me in the last couple of weeks. I was asked to speak. I won't say which company because it was all off the record, but I was asked to speak at a company annual gathering, and there was approximately 150 dealership general managers present. And during the Q&A, they were asking me questions, but then at one point, because this is on my mind, I asked them. And I said, I want to turn the tables and ask you guys a question. And I said, how many of you think, or how many, I said, how many of you are interested in selling electric and extended range electric vehicles? One hand went up.
Wow.
And that guy was from Holland. And I said, and I was at the, when I got into a scrum with these guys, I said, so what's the deal? And, you know, and I asked the CEO of the company, too. He said, look, these dealers and dealership general managers and salesmen are interested in what they can sell today with the least amount of resistance. Generally speaking, dealerships are not so interested in educating their buyers. And electric and extended range vehicles require a level of education that's not going to happen at the dealer level. And so that's why the OEMs have to do it. They have to be much more creative about doing it. And the advertising, I will be honest with you, I don't think much of most of the Volt advertising I've seen coming from General Motors.
Well, it's working twice as well as the Leaf you go by sales last month.
I mean,
come on. You know, this is pushing a string uphill, a wet string uphill. The market demand is not there. It's not there for hybrids either. There's pockets of the country and pockets of the world where they sell well. And it all happens to be under the Toyota Prius brand name, by the way, because nothing else as a hybrid sells in any real numbers. And this is regulators trying to tell the market what it should buy. It's failed in the past. It's failing right now. And throwing more money at it isn't going to turn the situation around.
Well, I agree with you because there's the carrot of the tax credits. But there needs to be a much bigger policy structure, as they did in Europe, in order to create a scaled change in the country. I here's the thing. I think people are just put off by the idea of the Volt. If they drove it and it was, I mean, $399 a month lease is not bad, you know, for a car with that much technology.
That's out of reach of most people.
That it is. It depends on what you're
That's luxury car territory for, you know, Main Street America.
I'll be honest. And here's the problem. You know, I talked to a BMW executive.
What it is, $399? It launched at $350, yeah, $351.
But, what happened was they took the leases off for a while, and sales
plummeted.
Well, here's the big mistake, and I know GM is not prone to making these kinds of mistakes.
But he said, dripping with sarcasm.
I was at Pebble Beach, and I was sitting next to a pretty high-ranking guy at BMW, and he said, you know, frankly, we were shocked when we drove it. We were shocked that they didn't introduce it as a Cadillac, not because of the pricing advantage that you get when you give it a luxury, but that's how good we thought it was. We thought they were crazy to put it out as a Chevy.
Yeah, I've heard that before, but, you know, GM is so obsessed with Chevy being Chevy.
But look, it's not even that. It's that if they were selling that as a Cadillac, the sales would be a fraction of what they are, simply from the number of dealers. And that's why they offered it as a Chevy. Yeah. They put $1 billion into this car. They're worried like crazy if it's going to sell or not. They got to amortize and ultimately pay off the costs.
Yep.
And
no,
it's not happening.
It's they. You know what? I kind of feel like they need somebody to go in with a fresh set of eyes to kind of take over the program. I really do.
Oh, like and that's going to happen.
Well, I know it's not going to happen, but it's
not going to happen because my argument is this is why I say listen to the dealers. They're in the trenches. They're talking to the people who come into the store and lay down their money or don't.
Right. I know,
and,
but,
you know, that's all I'm – and, you know, I'm with you. I think ultimately electric cars are the way to go. I think if we can get lightweight hub motors especially, we could do awesome things with cars. We could totally change the architecture of a vehicle for the better, much more space efficient and whatnot. All I'm saying is it ain't ready for prime time now, and it's probably not going to be ready even if you listen to the EPA. You know, I did an interview with Margot Oge from the EPA. Even their studies show that by 2025, that's 1% of the market.
Yeah.
It's
for
just not
EVs,
happening.
For EVs.
For EVs. And when you talk to the Natural Resources Defense Council, they're twice as bullish as the EPA. They think it'll get to 2% by 2025.
I know we don't want to blow the whole night in this, but I just want to say what's a shame is that people aren't – I think that a lot of people that are either criticizing it or writing it off haven't driven it. I found it to
I agree with you.
I found it to be one of the most fun driving experiences that I've ever had.
I totally agree. Don't get me wrong. I'm an EV enthusiast in that regard. I think that's cool technology. I like driving the Leaf a lot. I like driving the Volt a lot. Never driven the Mitsubishi i, so I can't say. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against the technology. I'm not against the driving experience. I think it's terrific.
I'm just saying this
government policy of trying to tell the people this is what you must buy is never going to work. It never has worked. It's not working now. It's not going to work in the future.
Well, and that's, again, that's not the way Europe went at it. And they've done a much smarter kind of.
Well, I think we should have just borrowed their model. I think we should do more.
We should adopt their model on healthcare too, but we're not going to do that.
Yeah. Hey, I got to talk though. Before we get to our guest with the Volkswagen, I went to the Mazda launch of the CX-5. Excuse me. And I only mention that, boy, I'm so excited about the trip because I haven't been out traveling much, and I got to go do this launch. It was a riot. And they've done some really cool things with that car. They took us to, I want to say Laguna Seca, but they drilled into our minds Mazda Raceway at Laguna Seca.
Sorry.
Right, of course. What did they spend $1 million, Peter?
You know, I know Mazda supports grassroots racing, but that is the dumbest thing. And I just absolutely refuse to call it Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. They should have called it Laguna Seca, brought to you by Mazda, anything but that. And every racing enthusiast in the country. Every racing enthusiast in the country, I'm sure, absolutely refuses to call it that, too. It's just so, you trip over it. It's just like, but.
I'm also never going to call Giant Stadium MetLife Stadium. I'm just not going to do it.
It's hard for me to say Mazda Raceway, only because since I was a little kid, I've known about Laguna. I've known about the corkscrew. The corkscrew may be the best turn in all motor racing. It's certainly one of the greatest.
It's one of them.
I would say the greatest. The greatest that I've driven, at least. And that what was amazing about the CX-5 is this has got the whole Skyactiv thing. The stupidest name in the business.
It is.
Skyactiv. Oh, my God. You know, but, their whole approach is really good. And so, you know, at first I thought, this is so bogus. They're bringing us to Laguna because they named the raceway. They pay $1 million. They got to get this stuff on. And they're taking this little SUV right out on the track. How dumb is that? Well, until I started driving it. And that dumb little SUV is a terrific little vehicle to drive. They've done some really good stuff with it. And we did a thing on Autoline Daily today to go after weight reduction. They even reduced the size of the heads of the bolts that they use on the car.
Yeah.
And so the diameter of the bolt is the same, the length of the bolt is the same, but the head is smaller, and they save like 8 grams per volt. I love that attention to detail.
That's
awesome.
That's a great idea until until you go in there with a socket wrench and try to undo something, and it kind of strips off because there's not enough.
Well, they claim because it is sort of a funny hex-like kind of head, but they claim that a regular socket will fit it.
Yeah.
So. But I'll take them at the word.
I was not on the trip, but I have driven the Mazda 3 with SkyActiv, and I thought it was tremendous. It didn't seem like I was getting quite as high a highway mileage as they advertised.
No, but here's why, David, because the SkyActiv in the 3 is only the powertrain.
Okay.
It was only the quote-unquote SkyActiv powertrain, blah, 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 blah. And we could get into more details on it. Anyway, they've used that philosophy from scratch. I mean, the CX-5 is a clean sheet piece of paper kind of car.
Mm-hmm.
So it can lap Laguna Mazda Raceway. It can lap it faster than the 3, even though it's a bigger and heavier SUV compared to the Mazda 3. So now I think it's got bigger wheels and tires, the CX-5. Okay. But nonetheless, it was able to lap Laguna, so the Mazda people say, faster than the Mazda 3.
And am I right that they're also going to bring a diesel of that to the States?
They are. They are. Yeah. And intriguingly, a low-compression diesel. I mean, diesels are usually like 20, 21-to-1 compression or something like that.
Right.
I think this diesel's like 14-to-1. So I think they've done that to get the NOx way down so that they don't need this massive after-treatment, complex that's really costly.
Is that their diesel or did they buy
it?
Yes.
No, it's theirs.
It's their homegrown diesel.
Yeah. This is I think Mazda's a cool little company.
Yeah,
like I said, they got to become the Alfa Romeo of Japan.
Well, they got to do something about their overcapacity first.
And also, I'm dubious that they can survive on their own. They need to partner up.
Hell, Alpha can't even become Alpha.
Mazda's
going to become Alpha.
Hey, we got to get to the next part of the program here, where we're going to be talking with a guy named Paul Schilperer, who's also Skyping in like David is tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul's coming in from The Hague in the Netherlands, and he's written this really amazing book about this Jewish engineer who grew up in Germany in the last century, a guy named Josef Ganz, who became a magazine editor. He was an engineer and really started putting all these ideas together of what a lightweight, very inexpensive people's car could become. What he called, I think, like way before we ever knew about it, he called it a Volkswagen. We need, he was saying Germany needs to build a Volkswagen. So Paul's put this book together that really documents how this guy really sort of conceptualized what we know as the Beetle. And as I said before, we've got a Beetle right here in the studio. And Peter, you're saying you're really impressed by this car.
Oh, the redo of the Beetle, I think, is really good. And it looks really good on the road. And mm-hmm. you don't know how different it looks from the previous redo until you see it on the road. I think it's really a nice package.
Right. The other new Beetle that we no longer can call the new Beetle, but you know what I'm talking about, was sort of cartoony and very sort of bulbousy.
They dropped the new for this car.
It's new
with a small N.
They dropped the new, but also it's sleeker. It's
much better looking, yeah.
Hey,
they got that roof line perfect. I mean,
totally.
Really perfect.
It's funny that you mentioned that, David, because that's what's really been striking me about the car, too, is the roof line on it.
I mean, the previous one, the whole thing, I mean, it basically looked like a breast. I mean, I thought, though. I mean, it was that and it was, and you know, and it was a chick scar. Although you'd think that with it being that much resembling a breast, that guys would have gone for it, but they really didn't.
Hey, before we start getting in with Paul here, we got to take a quick commercial break. And Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Well, Paul, welcome to Out of Line After Hours.
Hi, good evening.
Good to have you on the show. So now I'm going to make fun of your name here because I'm not sure if I've been saying this right at all this week. Schilperord.
Well, you came pretty close. It's Schilperord, but I don't think anybody outside of Holland can pronounce that correctly.
Schilperord.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Quite...
Okay. Yeah. Every time I say your name, I feel like I'm speaking Dutch.
Well, you are, basically.
There's way too many vowels in some of your words and names in a very short space.
But, hey, this book that you've written, at first I was very skeptical. You know, what do you mean some Jewish engineer came up with the design of the original Volkswagen? But here's your book, and I found it fascinating to go through. I learned a whole lot on it. But whatever got you into writing about this in the first place?
Well, that was more or less by chance, actually. I mean, I've been a Beatle enthusiast all my life, and I knew about the general history that we all know, that Hitler and Porsche developed this car together. Hitler as the financier, Porsche as the engineer. But one day I read, actually in an American magazine, Automobile Quarterly, which you must know very well.
Absolutely.
There's an issue from 1980, which is quite a good article on the origins of the Volkswagen Beetle that goes into all the details of the Tatra cars and all that. And in there, there were a few lines about Joseph Ganz. That's why I first read about it. And I was just simply intrigued by the very idea that a Jew could be behind the most successful thing that the Nazis ever did. So that's what prompted me to start and research this story.
I never thought the most the most successful thing the Nazis ever did was the Beatles.
Well, it's the most long-lasting.
No one's ever said that before that I've heard. That's pretty good. But well, Paul, before we get more into this, what's your background? I mean, you're not a journalist. You know. Tell people a little bit about yourself and what got you to go into this.
Well, my background is in mechanical engineering and product design. But I've worked as a journalist for about 10 years now.
Oh, okay.
Writing about that field. So I write mainly about innovative technologies, including car design as well, product design, and some historical stories as well. I mean, I'm quite fascinated myself about all these wacky, crazy engineers from the past who did the most remarkable things. And it's just wonderful to retell those stories now and then.
So, David Kiley, you wrote a book on the Beetle. Had you heard any of this background before at all?
The name of Josef Ganz certainly came up. But, you know, one thing I wanted to mention is that Ferdinand Porsche has Jewish blood in his in the family line, which was something that he, tried to, for obvious reasons, suppress during the 1930s. But I want to ask you something, Paul, which is because, and you get into wonderful scholarship in this book. And the part that I'm a little hung up on, people who have followed the Beetle history know that Ferdinand Porsche was designing cars at Tatra before he got into the Beetle project. And there was a vehicle at Tatra that certainly looks like a forerunner to the Beetle. But as I was reading your book, you seem to imply that Tatra kind of and tell me if I sort of took the wrong thing away, that Tatra actually kind of appropriated Ganz's design for the Standard Superior for that car that we kind of have long looked at as again sort of the forerunner, the precursor to the Type 1 Volkswagen.
Let me start by saying that there are quite some stories around. And not all of them are true. I mean, I've seen cars in museums which they claim have been designed by Porsche, which they haven't. I mean, Porsche never worked at Tatra, as far as I've been able to find out. Mm-hmm. And what Tatra did, I mean, they started in the 1920s using the backbone chassis and swinging axis at the rear, which you can find on the Beetle. So Gans was influenced by that. But Tatra was not the first company to start with the Beetle concept, so putting the engine in the back, using this streamlined bodywork. That's where that originated from Gans. And there are some stories around also that Tatra built a rear-engined Volkswagen-like car in 1931. But some new research, also by other people, not just by myself, suggests that that car was actually not built before 1933, and that evidence was more or less falsified later on. Sure. So as far as I've been able to establish, it was Gans who put together the first Beetle-like car, so adopting the backbone chassis, independent wheel suspension all around with swing axles at the back, putting the engine in the back, of course, using a Beetle-like bodywork on it, and of course making the whole thing very lightweight, adopted to mass production for a low cost, even naming it a Volkswagen and even nicknaming it a Beetle. That's what Gans did in 1930 and 1931. That's when he built his first two prototypes. That's when the race starts. Then that's when you see other companies like Porsche and Tatra Company. They start to adopt these principles. They start turning out prototypes according to the same lines as the Gans cars.
So, Paul, do you think Porsche actually studied Gans's car to do what he did?
Yeah, well, actually, I found some evidence that suggests that Porsche even test drove Gans's prototype in 1931. So before he ever created a Beetle-like car, the first Beetle-like car that Porsche designed was the Zünder prototype, which came out in the spring of 1932. But before that, at the end of 1931, he test drove the Maybach prototype by Joseph Gans.
Let me ask you, do you think that, and I confess that I haven't gotten to the end of the book yet, but do you think that Porsche really, I mean, are you kind of making the case that Porsche lifted the idea, the design, and this sort of thing from Gans's car, or are there innovations in what became the Type 1 where you would say that Porsche built on things that Gans had done?
Well, I mean, the role of Gans was really as the originator of the concept of the Beetle. So the technical concept, but also making a car for a price of 1,000 Reichsmarks, which was also the price that Hitler later propagated. But when you go into the details, of course, there are a lot of differences. I mean, the concept is the same, the Gans concept and the Porsche concept. But in details, there are a lot of differences, of course. So you can't really say that Porsche stole any drawings or patents by Gans. That's simply not true, but he was heavily influenced by the work that Gans did. Mm-hmm. I mean, I personally think if it wasn't for Gans, then Porsche would never have started making these little rear-engined cars. That's where Gans came in.
In my research for the book I did, it came out 10 years ago, I mean, it seemed to me with all the stuff that I read that Porsche did have this idea and this passion of a people's car, of a car that the working person could afford not only to buy but to operate. Something was economical and very simple to operate, to fix, to maintain, and all of that. And then Hitler was influenced by the Henry Ford story and the Model T, and it was you know, when people put Porsche and Hitler together, you know, in a meeting to see if there was common ground and if Porsche would be the engineer to sort of execute Hitler's idea for this people's car. So But my memory of it is that Porsche also had this idea and had worked on concepts and drawings and systems probably concurrent with GANs.
Well, there are a lot of stories that Porsche designed some rear-engined Volkswagen-like prototypes at Mercedes in the late 1920s when he was employed there. But there is no evidence whatsoever that can be found about that. The stories are there, but I've looked into it quite extensively, and there's simply no evidence of that. I mean, there is one letter from 1930, I think, in which Porsche says to the Mercedes company after he had been fired, he wants to come back to Mercedes, and he says to the board of directors that he had something like perfected the Volkswagen idea, or the idea of a cheap people's car. At the Steyr company in Austria, where he worked for 1 or 2 years, but again, there are no drawings or anything of these cars, and it's unclear whether any prototypes have ever been built. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first work that we can really see is the Zunda prototype from 1932, but from what I found, that actually originated not from Porsche's passion to build a people's car, but the story seems to be. That Porsche's passion was more with racing cars. That's also what we can see in his career, of course.
Yeah.
For Mercedes, he always built very big, expensive, heavy sports cars and racing cars. And when he started on his own in 1931, he wanted to start a racing car project. And he was looking for financing for this project, and he found the Zundapp company. And Zundapp, this is a little known fact, but Zundapp promised Porsche to sponsor the racing car project if Porsche would build a Volkswagen prototype for them, because they were influenced by the Maybach prototype by GANs, and they wanted to outsmart GANs by coming onto the market with a Volkswagen before he would be able to. So they asked Porsche to design that Volkswagen, and in return they would sponsor the racing car project that Porsche wanted to fulfill. Mm-hmm.
Paul, that's what I love about your book, is you get into so much detail, and it's so well researched. And as you speak with Porsche, I want to read one of the sentences in your book that I found extraordinary. And it says, in fact, Daimler-Benz wanted nothing more to do with Porsche, having accused him of funneling company secrets to competitors in an illegal manner via his design bureau. And then you go on to say that Daimler-Benz said that if they found anybody talking to Porsche, they would be sacked on the spot. What was that about?
Yeah, all this information comes from a number of letters that I found in Berlin in the official state archives. Again, these are letters which are they are not very well known, and I think the problem is with a lot of the Beetle books that have come out in the past years that people look at other books as sources, but not a lot of people go back to the original sources and really go to Berlin and Frankfurt and all the places where I've been to look into the original documents from the 1920s and the 1930s. So I found these letters, and they were letters written between Porsche and the board of directors at Mercedes, but also internal letters from Mercedes. And this was all about around the late 1920s, early 1930s, when Porsche had left the company. But Porsche wanted to return, but Mercedes was very unhappy with him because, as you just said, they accused Porsche of funneling company secrets to competitors. I mean, of course, we don't know exactly what is true. I mean, were they just accusations? Was it really true? This is very difficult, of course, and maybe Mercedes just wanted to. They were not very happy with the fact that Porsche had left their company and was now using that knowledge from, I don't know how long he worked there, but many years throughout the 1920s, I think.
But didn't
using?
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Paul.
Go ahead.
Using all that information now for other companies, of course. When he started for his own design company, he started working for other car manufacturers. So started, of course, selling ideas. Maybe some ideas came from Mercedes. We don't know exactly. But there are letters that say that anybody even if it was the wife of an employee of Mercedes who talked to Porsche, then the employee would be fired on the spot. I mean, it was that serious, apparently.
Well, you know, I was going to say, I mean, this sort of stuff, it's not surprising, right? If you, having worked at Mercedes for a long time, and then he goes and opens, he was not a happy relationship, and then he goes off to start his own thing. You can't sort of empty out your head of everything that you've been working on and learning and about Mercedes stuff. And then when you start applying your own craft, the company that you worked for they were very litigious, very patent oriented, you know, back then. So it's not surprising there was a lot of bad blood, but your scholarship on it is awesome. I really salute you.
What were you going to say, Peter?
Well, Porsche, if I'm not mistaken, was the chief engineer designer of the Mercedes-Benz SSK, the legendary SSK sports car.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's correct, yeah.
Paul, what would you get out of doing all this research on Josef Ganz? I think he's a fascinating guy, but I'm troubled by his character, too. You know, he lives with this woman for a whole long time, then he dumps her. He's this editor of a magazine, but he's also being paid by BMW and Mercedes, something that would be highly unethical today. And I'm sure it was unethical back then. Or did his readers understand that, or did his readers know it? And I'm just asking a bunch of questions, I know, but what's your overall take of Josef Ganz?
Well, of course, I've been studying this guy for, 6 to 7 years by now. And this was a very difficult subject in the research as well. I found all these documents, all this information, and to distill from that exactly what he was like. Because, I found a lot of documents that spoke for him, very positive about him, but also some people from the other camp, some enemies of Ganz, who said that it was ridiculous that he was a journalist and then started working for the industry as well. And then so he would criticize the cars that he helped design, which is, of course, you could say a dubious position to be in. But I did a lot of research into this, and I do think that Ganz did try to work with a lot of ethics. I mean, the first car that he helped develop at Mercedes was the Mercedes 170 model, which came out at the end of 1931. Which is the first Mercedes car with independent suspension all around and swing axles at the back. And Ganz, Ganz went on the test drive with Mercedes for the Swiss Alps, testing a couple of these prototypes, and he wrote about that in Motor Critique. And he was very favorable about the car, but, I mean, he wasn't completely jubilant. I mean, he also said that this was just a first step in a modern development, that Mercedes had at least taken the first step towards a more modern, progressive car, but that a lot of work still needed to be done. So, but it's difficult. I mean, there was another magazine, the biggest rival of Ganz's magazine at the time, who accused him of, designing cars and then criticizing them. So, yeah, have your pick. I mean, I guess it's a personal opinion. I don't know if there's any example of a person who does that nowadays. Do you know of anybody, any journalist who also works as a consultant?
I wouldn't be surprised if it happens, but nobody would go telling the world about that. Let me tell you that.
Well, there's always
I found him a little bit troubling. I mean, he's a complex individual.
Yeah, definitely.
But I got to tell everybody, the name of the book is Josef Ganz, you know, for our Americans, more like Josef Ganz. It's called The Jewish Engineer Behind Hitler's Volkswagen. Paul Schilperrord is the author. It's a cool book. I learned a ton about the early, you know, years, especially in the 20s and 30s of the German auto industry. I recommend the book. It's anybody who's into the industry will learn stuff from it.
I absolutely do. And I have to say, when I was not aware of the book, and then I read a review on it, and I had the same feeling that I had about another book, which I want to give a plug to, since we're talking about Volkswagens. I honestly was surprised that there was new stuff to write about. I mean, there's so many Volkswagen books that have been turned out, And so I was just wonderfully surprised, not only with your book, but there's another book out that I want to give a plug to, and I happen to have lunch with the author today. Her name is Andrea Hyatt, and her book is called Thinking Small, The Long, Strange Trip of the Volkswagen Beetle. It's a very different book than Paul's, but I have to say, if you're into Volkswagens, she did a really interesting job. She wrote it from Germany as well. She's an American, but she's a journalist in Germany, and wrote about that whole time from a really a different perspective, and got into it's really an intersection of the Beatle and culture and the German political scene in the 30s, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So Thinking Small by Andrea Hyatt and The Extraordinary Life of Josef Ganz by Paul Schilperud.
Close enough.
We recommend them both.
Paul, people have made fun of my name all my life, so you're just going to have to live with me making fun of yours.
Yeah.
But hold on, guys. Look, let's take another commercial break, and then let's get to rapid fire and take everybody's questions that are coming in. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, it's time to get to rapid fire, and Ben, let's get it started. Okay, Paul, you got a question from Jim. He says, how many auto executives are still with the companies from the era you wrote about? None!
Yeah, that's simple to answer. But the interesting thing is, of course, that the Porsche family is still heavily involved in both the Volkswagen company and the Porsche company.
Good point. But the executives that Paul writes about in his book,
long gone.
They're up there in the sky with Ike.
Yeah. I had one quick sort of thing that I stumbled over in the book, Paul, which was there was a figure involved in 1930 whose name was Carl Hahn, and I thought, wow, that can't be the same Carl Hahn who went on to run Volkswagen later on. It must be a common name in Germany, yeah?
Well, he could actually be related. I'm not sure on this, but it could very well be a relation.
I'm glad you brought that up, David, because I even underlined that. In fact, Paul, I got to tell you, I underlined a number of things in your book, and I never do that in books, or rarely do it in books, unless there's really good stuff. But that is one of the things I underlined was Carl Hahn's name, because, of course, there was a Carl Hahn who ran Volkswagen in the 1990s. Did a very good job of it, by the way, too.
He's still alive, because I Googled him and said, yeah, that Carl Hahn is born in 1926. So unless he was a four-year-old executive, it's not.
No. But I wouldn't be surprised. That's not at all unusual for, you know, sons to follow in their father's footsteps in the automotive industry.
Could be.
Okay, Jeff W. says, question for Peter. If GM took his advice and broke the Corvette out as its own brand, would you also recommend that Corvettes be sold through Cadillac stores and not Chevrolet?
Certain Cadillac dealers maybe, but mainly Chevrolet.
Do you think Corvette sales are held back because most Chevrolet dealers do not know how to cater to the kind of customer a Corvette attracts?
No, I think Corvette sales are held back because they've stayed with the current product too long. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem for some Chevy dealers. But the dealers who sell a lot of Corvettes know how to treat the Corvette customer. There's no doubt. I mean, the new car that's coming, what's the biggest drawback for most consumers or enthusiast consumers that knock the car is the interior. They expect that the new car has that fixed.
Okay,
well,
for him.
Because I've seen too much parts bin stuff in the last couple of Corvettes, and as far as the interior goes.
Yeah.
Okay, formerly Baja Busta says, do you think that if they lowered the price of the Volt to get sales figures up and get it into the hands of more people, would that help, David? Lower the price of the Volt.
Lower. Well, see, they would start out selling it at a loss then, and I think now the retail price they're kind of at break even, and then it makes, and then the tax incentives bring it down. Obama says he's raising it to 10,000, so that'll bring a Volt, the real cost of a Volt for a lot of people, down to about 33,000 if you get the nav system and with destination fees. You know, $33,000, I got to tell you, $33,000 bottom line for a car with that much technology and drives like, I think, competitively with an Audi, you know, A3 or something like that, $33,000 is not that much money anymore. That's my feeling.
Well, I know, but I'm telling you, Main Street America, $33,000, that's a hefty price to lay out. Anything over 30, man, is a lot of money for most people.
But, you know, if you could get – and the problem, again, the badging, the Chevy Volt, because you're really in a price point where you're starting to compare your – you know, if you're doing head-to-head comparisons, fuel economy aside – you're basically comparing against Volvos and Acuras.
Yeah,
and
but wait a minute.
Owen
what
Audis?
About Nissan? Should they have gone Infiniti with the Leaf?
Well, the Leaf, yeah, actually, because the Leaf is now 30.
They raised the price.
Well, they did it for the same reasons, you know, that GM did it with Chevy. They wanted the scale and the coverage.
Look, I'm telling you, it's all driven by finances. These guys have bet the farm, or, you know, certainly Carlos Ghosn's bet the farm. He's all in, and they just need the volume. Anyway,
I'll tell you what else they need.
This is rapid fire. We got to get to the next one.
That's what they.
Paul, I got one for you. This is interesting. I'm not sure I understand this. This is from G. Long Vic, who asks, "Where does the history of Hans Ledwinka fit in with the history of the Beetle? The Czech history of the concept of the Beetle is the real story that needs to be discussed. The Tatra Mountains and the Czech Republic are the real story of the Beetle. Discuss this in the real history of the VW Beetle if you dare."
Well, I did dare because Tatra is a big part of my book. And as I show in my book, it's actually Tatra that has been... Well, Gans was inspired, as I said earlier, by the Tatra cars from the 1920s. With their backbone chassis and swinging axles at the rear. But it was Gans who put together the real Beetle concept for the first time. And after that, it was Tatra that was inspired by Gans to build a Beetle-like car. And that's where the idea originated for Tatra to build. I don't know if you're aware with the streamlined cars that came out in the 30s, the big Tatra cars.
Yes.
They were like massive Beetles with air-cooled V8 engines in the back.
Awesome cars. They're beautiful.
I owned one of the 1970s models myself, the Tatra 603 from 1972. Still a huge streamlined car with an air-cooled V8 in the back. Fantastic car. But these cars, they were inspired by the work that Gans did. And in 1933-34, Tatra actually started to sue Gans before the courts because they claimed that Gans had stolen Tatra patents, that he had infringed upon Tatra patents for the work on his Volkswagens. And that case dragged on from 1933 until 1941, so into the war years.
Wow.
And this is all described in my book. I was quite amazed by to find all this. And even more so to find out that Gans, he was by then a refugee living in Switzerland. But his lawyer, would you believe this, his lawyer was actually Jewish, working in Berlin, one of the last Jews to work in Germany. Wow. He had a special status because he did a lot of heroic stuff during the First World War. So he had a special status. He just needed to adopt the first name Israel to show that he was a Jew. But he was still allowed to work as a lawyer until 1941. And the last case that he did, or one of the last cases, was the Tatra versus Gans case. And his Jewish lawyer won the case for a Jewish refugee in Berlin in 1941.
Wow.
And Tatra actually had to pay Gans something like 4,500 Reichsmark at the time.
And Jeffrey Figer thinks he's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an inside joke, Paul. Don't worry about it.
That's impressive that that kind of litigation was going on.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Hey, but Josef Ganz admired Hans Ledwinka, right?
Oh, yeah, he did. He admired Ledwinka.
And I should say, Porsche. Ledwinka is the guy who was the chief engineer of Tatra?
Yeah. Well, Ganz met him for the first time in 1928, and Ganz and Ledwinka, and also Ganz and Porsche, they all discussed their designs, I think. The big guys in the industry at that time, they all met each other at car races and things like that. They visited each other at the factories, and they discussed ideas. So, I mean, we will never know how much Porsche was influenced by Ledwinka, how much Ledwinka was inspired by Porsche, and Ganz by Porsche, and Porsche by Ganz. I mean, all these people talked together. They met with each other. I even have photographs of Ferdinand Porsche taken by Ganz. They're in my book as well.
Mm-hmm.
So all these guys knew each other. They met each other. And
sure, they influenced each other.
And, you know, we at auto shows, you know, the second media day or the first industry day, what do we see? We see the designers and the engineers pouring over the cars at the auto shows with tape measures, you know.
Of course.
And you see them off in the corners talking with one another. And, you know, a lot of these guys, some are a bit rivalrous, a lot of friends, but it's a great part of the business.
Okay, yeah, we got some phone calls coming in. Ben, let's get to the first.
Hey, John, Rick from San Diego. Hey, Ben, looking at this GM Opel PSA thing, and buying PSA for buying into PSA, and I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense. But I had four plants in Opel that they couldn't keep up to capacity, and then they get 11 more from PSA that has two product lines that are almost identical. And instead of just offering an Opel 3 Series competitor to boost up the capacity issues in the Opel plants and make a lot of money, which BMW proved you can do, as did VW, so a couple extra brands isn't really the issue. It's how you use them, and GM hasn't really been very good at doing that lately. Thanks.
Okay, let's...
Yeah, what do you think, Peter? What do you think of this Peugeot move by GM?
I think GM is frightfully optimistic that this is going to prove to be beneficial. I think there's... The name of the game in Europe is overcapacity. And this does not address that, best I can tell. So we'll see, but I think they're way bullish on the ultimate positive impact that it will have.
Yeah, David, what do you make of this PSA move with GM?
Peter, what was the bottom line investment for GM, though?
It's like $423 million.
Yeah, you know, they lose $423 million in the couch cushions over at the Rensen. You know, I mean, that's like half a refresh or something.
Yeah, but Paul, David, why don't you just take that money and shut a plant down? I mean, that's the kind of money it's going to take to shut a plant down, probably even a little bit more.
You're right. They start talking about...
I mean, their problem's over capacity. Their problem's not that they don't have enough partners.
Right. Look at
what their other tie-ups did for them. Nothing.
Well, I was going to say, they don't have a good history with these things. All the partnerships and alliances they had, for the most part, are gone. But and the ones that they did were horrible in the 90s. So the investment is small, you know, relatively speaking. You know, why not? I mean, if they might have a roadmap to create more efficiencies between them in Europe, but it'll be in the details. It'll be in the execution.
Yeah,
and
I'll give them that. They haven't come out and announced what their plan is, so I'm waiting to see what the plan is. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
Their plan is $2 billion in profit.
Yeah.
I said that.
Well, anyway, hey, Paul, we've got a question from Andrew who says, after your research on the book, what do you think of Ferdinand Porsche now?
Yeah, good question. Well, I mean, in the case of Ganz, you can't really blame Porsche directly. I mean, Porsche is also a complicated character. I mean, Ganz and Porsche, they were friends, I think. They also met after the war, for the last time shortly before Porsche died, and they parted on good terms, so I don't think there was really any bad blood between Ganz and Porsche. And Ganz, I think he was actually impressed by the developments that Porsche did. He just wanted recognition for his part in the whole Volkswagen history. But of course, Porsche went on, but this is not my research, this is something we already knew, that Porsche went on, of course, to, I mean, he developed the Volkswagen for Hitler, but he'd also developed an amphibious car, a Jeep, sure, and numerous other military vehicles.
Yeah, a whole family of vehicles, yeah.
Isn't the Tiger
Yeah, even,
tank.
Even tanks, I think.
Mm-hmm. I thought he so did the Tiger tank.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult discussion. Was he, by that, a war criminal, or was he just an engineer who saw an opportunity to do some amazing engineering?
You know,
I'm reminded of an old song that said, "Nazi schmatzi," said Werner von Braun.
You know, fair or not, all the stuff I digested on Ferdinand Porsche, my conclusion was this was a guy who was obsessed with cars and engines and design, and he didn't pay. It seemed to me to be a character, and this is not defense, because this is, he just wasn't that interested in the politics of it all. He really seemed to view all this as a means to an end, so that he could just keep working, you know, on stuff that
he was definitely not anti-Semitic either, because I think this is also a little known fact, but one of the guys who helped finance the Porsche company in 1931 was a Jew as well. Mm-hmm. He's called Adolf Rosenberger. I don't know if you found out anything about him, David.
No, it's been a while since I did the research, but his name doesn't ring a bell. But as I said earlier, Porsche had Jewish blood too. So,
yeah, yeah.
And he also, I mean, he did do some benevolent things for workers that, you know, were consigned to the factory. You know, he did things he didn't have to do but he is a complicated guy, no question about it.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got another phone call in here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hey, guys. Andrew Jackson here from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I enjoyed Peter's commentary on the Speed Network's Dave Spain Wind Tunnel show the other night, but would just like to voice my displeasure with seeing yet another good-looking station wagon, the Chevy Cruze, introduced in Europe and not coming to America. Thanks, guys.
What do you think, Peter? I mean, you and I'm sure, I love little wagons, man.
Me
I think
too.
They're cool. Yeah, but they just don't sell here.
Yeah, they don't. And it's too bad, but
maybe it'll change.
Yeah.
You know, hatchbacks are, you know, becoming popular again in the U.S., although the numbers aren't all that big yet. Maybe wagons will make a comeback, but
I don't understand the love of a sedan. I can't imagine buying a sedan myself again. There's just so much more utility to hatches and sport wagons. And I'm with you, caller. I wish the Cruze wagon was coming here, because I'm a Cruze fan.
Okay, we got another question here, Peter. The new Beetle looks amazing, but don't you think it's gotten too big?
Not really. I don't think so.
I don't either. You know, you gotta, if you look at it in pictures, it might look bigger, you know, because it's got this sort of organic, you know, it's a two-box design, really. But, yeah, when you're up close to it and all that, it doesn't look big. It doesn't look out of proportion whatsoever.
It definitely has a much more aggressive presence on the road than the old one.
Yeah. Hey, we got another phone call. Let's bring that one in, Ben.
Hi, John. This is Victor Cc's, otherwise known as Geelong Vic, currently living in Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question for you and your interview person. Where does Hans Litvinke fit into the entire VW story? Because does not he have an important contribution to the VW story? Thank you.
I
think we answered that, right? Paul?
Yeah, we answered that.
We answered most of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, Litvinke definitely has influence in the whole story. I think I answered a lot of that already. And in the 1930s, I mean, Tatra turned out some cars, which there's one model, the T97 from 1938, I think it is, which looks a lot like the Beetle, but I mean, there were a lot of developments going on more or less at the same time. Porsche was working on his prototypes in Germany. Ledwinka was working on his cars in the Czech Republic. Ganz was working on his cars in Switzerland at that time. And, I mean, it becomes very difficult to say who exactly influenced who at one point. I mean, you can definitely say that Ganz originated the whole thing by building the first prototypes and propagating that. And after that, everybody starts building these rear-engined Volkswagen-like cars. And then it becomes very difficult to establish who exactly influenced who.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll make this the last question. Peter, to you. As Fisker, explain the Fisker thing, because we didn't really get into that earlier.
Oh, Consumer Reports, who doesn't let the manufacturers know when they get the cars, because they go buy them. That's the whole thing of
right.
Consumer Reports. They were doing road tests of the Fisker, and it conked out on them and stopped.
And they couldn't get it going
again.
Right.
So Fisker, of course, knows nothing of this, and then they call him and just say, hey, we're driving a Fisker and it stopped, you know.
So Brian wanted to know, as Fisker continues to slide towards oblivion, do you think, like Fisker, that without the DOE loans, Carbon Motors will survive or be a punchline?
Well, Carbon Motors, they just got turned down.
They got turned down by the Department of Energy.
I don't think they'll survive at all.
$300 million-plus dollars.
That was make or break money. And Carbon Motors is trying to rustle up some support in Congress to save it, but they're not going to survive.
Yeah.
It seems to me, starting with Solyndra, and then, you know, I think these DOE loans, frankly, I think they're going to be a lot harder to get. And it's going to be a program that there's so much money that's required for a car company, whatever, when you're on this small scale, frankly, I think a lot of these companies are just in it to try to get the DOE money, that's kind of the business model, and to walk away from it, because I don't have a lot of faith in these business models. I really don't.
Yeah. Hey, got to wrap it up, guys. But, hey, David, what's the name of your book on the Beetle? Tell people about it.
My book is Getting the Bugs Out, The Rise, Fall, and Comeback of Volkswagen in America. And it really does focus on the Beetle phenomenon in the U.S., although there is some German history.
You can get it on Amazon, or how do you get it?
You can still get it, yep. You can still get it on Amazon. And but I, you know, thanks for mentioning that book. I do just want to give one more last plug to Paul's great book that I encourage people to get, but also Andrea Hyatt's book, Thinking Small, which is brand new. It's just out, The Long Strange Trip of the Volkswagen Beetle.
And Paul, I highly recommend your book, but where can people get this?
This is also available on Amazon and many other booksellers as well. We started with the hardcover version, and the publisher has just released the second print, which is a paperback. And you can get both of these on Amazon as well.
Okay.
Paul, thanks very much. Very fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating. And
thanks for your hard work. The years that you spent in the archives, man, my hat's off to you.
Yeah, real impressive. And thank you too, David.
Thank you.
Thank you,
John and Peter.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It was a real pleasure to be on the show.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Peter, good show, man.
Good show.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear about Ike again.
My condolences.
Man, it hurt. He was a cool dog. He was a really cool dog. But life goes on.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, thanks for tuning in. It's been a great show, and we'll be back here next week. Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Yeah, Paul, now you can go to sleep now, finally.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Yeah.
It's 2 in the morning.
2 in the morning.
Are the bars still open?
Yeah.
Well, some might be. The more regular bars will be closed by now. But you can always find some sleazy place somewhere.
There you go.